A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to look at the history of transgender identity, how far back it goes, and whether the current political firestorm around it is really about something new, or something that's been with us across civilizations. He's also asking about the actual process of gender confirmation surgery, how it's regulated around the world, and how different political axes have engaged with lobby groups pushing for more rights. Two massive topics that each deserve their own episode, but he wants a broad introduction to both.
The timing couldn't be sharper. Over 500 anti-trans bills were introduced in U.S. state legislatures in the 2025 to 2026 session alone. The U.K. blocked the CAS Review's puberty blocker recommendations. We're in the middle of what feels like a global reckoning over gender identity, and a lot of the rhetoric frames it as some radical new invention of Western modernity. The historical record says otherwise.
That's what struck me reading Daniel's prompt. The assumption baked into so much of the current debate is that this is unprecedented, that we're navigating something humans have never encountered before. And that's just not true.
It's not even close to true. So let's structure this properly. First, we trace the documented cases of gender diversity across cultures and millennia. What did it look like before the modern medical framework existed? Then we'll look at how gender confirmation surgery actually works, how different countries regulate it, and how political movements have shaped access to care.
Before we dive in, there's a distinction we should make up front. The modern Western concept of transgender identity as an internal psychological state that may or may not lead to medical transition is one thing. The third gender categories we find across history, hijras in South Asia, Two-spirit in indigenous North American cultures, Fa'afafine in Samoa, are something related but not identical. They're social roles, often with religious or community functions, not necessarily about individual identity in the way we frame it now.
We're not doing the thing where we retroactively label everyone in history with modern categories, but we are pointing out that gender diversity is not a 21st century invention. The galley priests of ancient Rome. This goes back to at least the 2nd century BCE, where biological males who castrated themselves and adopted feminine dress and mannerisms in service of the goddess Cybele. They occupied a recognized social role that was neither male nor female in the conventional Roman sense.
Here's the thing. The Romans themselves found this unsettling. Roman citizens were legally prohibited from becoming galli. It was considered an Eastern import, something foreign and disturbing to traditional Roman values. Which, I mean, if you're looking for historical parallels to current cultural anxiety, there it is.
It's worth pausing on that parallel because it's almost uncanny. You had a Mediterranean imperial power encountering a gender-diverse religious tradition from Phrygia in what's now Turkey, and reacting with a mix of fascination and legislative hostility. The Senate actually debated restrictions on the galley.
It really does. And the specific anxiety was about Roman citizens, particularly young Roman men, being seduced by this foreign practice. The framing was that it was a corrupting Eastern influence undermining traditional Roman masculinity. Swap out a few nouns, and you could run that as a segment on a cable news channel tonight.
The pattern repeats across civilizations. Hijras in South Asia have been documented for over 4,000 years. They appear in the Kama Sutra, which dates to somewhere between 400 BCE and 200 CE. They appear in the Ramayana. They held positions in Mughal courts, and in 2014, the Indian Supreme Court legally recognized them as a third gender.
The Kama Sutra mention is interesting because it's not framed as exotic or aberrant. It's just catalogued as one of the varieties of human experience, which tells you something about the cultural framework being fundamentally different from the European pathologization that came later.
The Mughal court example is particularly striking. Hijras served as attendants in royal harems, as advisors, as guardians of the treasury in some cases. They had institutional power. This wasn't marginal tolerance. This was integration into the highest levels of political authority. Then British colonialism arrived and criminalized them under Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code in 1860. The colonial administration literally imposed a gender binary on a society that had recognized a third gender for millennia.
That's a pattern we see across the colonial world. European powers arrived with their binary frameworks and their Christian moral assumptions and systematically dismantled existing gender-diverse social roles. The two-spirit traditions in North America were actively suppressed through residential schools and legal prohibition. The Spanish in the Americas did the same thing. You can trace a direct line from colonial gender enforcement to the pathologization we're still dealing with.
You see similar recognition across Southeast Asia and the Pacific, in places where colonial influence was lighter or arrived later. The Bugis people of Indonesia have recognized five genders for centuries: male, female, Kalalai, Kalabai, and Bisu. The Bisu in particular are considered to embody both male and female essences, and traditionally serve as spiritual intermediaries. In Samoa, Fa'afafine are people assigned male at birth who embody both masculine and feminine traits, and they're fully integrated into family and community life. In Oman, the Zanath are biologically male but occupy a distinct social role with specific dress codes and behavioral expectations.
Can we talk about the Bisu for a moment? Because their role as spiritual intermediaries is fascinating. The idea is that you need someone who transcends the male-female binary to communicate with the spirit world. That the binary itself is a limitation, and spiritual power comes from bridging it. That's a radically different framework from, this is a medical condition that needs treatment.
It's almost an inversion of the Western model. In the Bugis framework, the Bisu aren't lacking something or suffering from a condition. They possess something additional. They have access to both male and female spiritual domains. It's a position of power, not pathology.
The idea that gender diversity is some modern Western invention collapses under even a cursory look at the historical record. What is modern and Western is the medicalization of it.
That's exactly where the story turns. The 19th and early 20th centuries saw European medicine start to classify and pathologize what had previously been understood as social or spiritual variation. Karl Heinrich Ulrichs in the 1860s developed a theory of Erning. He was primarily writing about what we'd now call male homosexuality, but his framework of a female soul in a male body became influential for decades. Then Magnus Hirschfeld opened the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin in 1919.
Hirschfeld is one of those figures who should be far better known than he is. The Institute was extraordinary. It provided medical care, conducted research, advocated for legal reform. Hirschfeld coined the term transvestite and pioneered the concept that gender identity was distinct from sexual orientation. He employed transgender staff, and in 1933, Nazi students burned the Institute's library. The famous book-burning photos you've seen from that era. Those are Hirschfeld's books and patient records.
The destruction of that archive is one of the great intellectual tragedies of the 20th century. We lost irreplaceable documentation of early gender-affirming care, but we do know what happened there. Dora Richter underwent the first documented vaginoplasty at the Institute in 1922. She lived as a woman, worked as a domestic servant at the Institute, and was likely killed in the Nazi raid. Lily Elba, whose story became the film, The Danish Girl, underwent a series of surgeries starting in 1930, including an experimental uterine transplant that led to her death from complications in 1931.
It's worth noting that Elba's surgeries were performed at the Dresden Municipal Women's Clinic, not at Hirschfeld's Institute, though Hirschfeld was involved in the preliminary assessments. The surgeon was Kurt Warnercross, and the uterine transplant that killed her. It was rejected by her body, and she died of cardiac arrest 3 months after the surgery. The technology just wasn't there yet, but the desire for it was. That's a through line in this history. People pursuing medical transition even when the risks were enormous.
Because the alternative, for many, was a life that didn't feel livable. Then Christine Jorgensen in 1952. She was a former U.S. Army private who traveled to Denmark for surgery, and the New York Daily News ran the front page headline, XGI becomes blonde beauty on December 1st of that year. The media coverage was sensational and often cruel, but it brought the concept of gender transition into American popular consciousness for the first time.
Jorgensen handled the media circus with remarkable grace. She gave interviews, she wrote an autobiography, she performed in nightclubs. She became a celebrity, which is a strange thing to become for having access medical care. But that celebrity probably did more to normalize the concept of transition for the American public than any amount of medical literature could have.
What's striking about the Jorgensen coverage is how it framed transition as a technological marvel. Science has done this, rather than as an expression of identity. The medical establishment positioned itself as the gatekeeper. And that gatekeeping became formalized in 1980 when the American Psychiatric Association introduced gender identity disorder into the DSM-III.
This is where the pathologization really crystallized. By putting it in the DSM, the APA was saying, this is a mental disorder. The diagnosis was required for access to care, which created this bizarre situation where you had to be declared mentally ill to receive treatment that would then, presumably, resolve the condition. The shift to gender dysphoria in the DSM-5 in 2013 was significant. It depathologized the identity while still recognizing the distress that can come from the mismatch.
As a retired pediatrician, I can tell you that distinction matters enormously in clinical practice. Gender dysphoria describes the distress, not the identity. It's the difference between saying being transgender is a disorder and saying the distress some transgender people experience is a treatable condition. That reframing opened the door to the informed consent models we see now.
It also created a tension that's still unresolved. If you remove the diagnosis entirely, how do people access insurance-covered care? The diagnosis is the key that unlocks the door. Remove the diagnosis, and you're potentially removing the funding mechanism. It's a practical problem that the depathologization advocates are still wrestling with.
That's the paradox of medical necessity. You need the diagnosis code to get the prior authorization. Some countries have solved this by moving gender-affirming care out of the mental health framework entirely and treating it as primary care. But that requires a fundamentally different insurance and regulatory structure than what most countries have.
If gender diversity has always been with us, how did we get from the galley priests to modern surgical techniques? That's where we turn next.
Let's talk about what the surgery actually involves, because I think most people have only the vaguest sense of it. For trans women, vaginoplasty, the creation of a vagina, has two main approaches. Penile inversion is the most common. The skin of the penis is inverted to create the vaginal canal. The glans is reshaped into a clitoris, and the scrotal tissue forms the labia. The alternative is the sigmoid colon technique, where a segment of the colon is used to create the canal. That one's used when there's not enough penile tissue or for revision surgeries.
The complication rates.
Vaginoplasty has a major complication rate of around 1 to 2%, things like fistula, stenosis, or necrosis. That's remarkably low for a surgery of this complexity. For trans men, phalloplasty, constructing a penis, is more involved. The most common technique is the radial forearm free flap, where tissue, nerves, and blood vessels are taken from the forearm to construct the phallus. The ALT flap from the thigh is another option. But the complication rate for phalloplasty is higher, 20 to 30% requiring revision. Urethral complications are the most common, followed by issues with the implant that allows for erection.
20 to 30% revision rate is significant, but it's also worth noting these are complex microsurgical procedures. The first successful hand transplant had complication rates in that range too. It's not that the surgery is uniquely risky. It's that connecting nerves and blood vessels at that scale is inherently difficult.
And the techniques keep improving. There are trials as of 2025 for robotic-assisted vaginoplasty, which offers greater precision. The field is evolving rapidly, but having the medical capability doesn't mean everyone can access it. And that's where politics enters the picture.
Can I ask a practical question? What does recovery actually look like for these procedures?
For vaginoplasty, you're looking at about a week in the hospital, then several weeks of very limited activity. The critical part is dilation. Patients need to dilate the vaginal canal regularly to prevent stenosis, which is narrowing or closure. The schedule is intensive at first, multiple times daily, and tapers down over the first year. Failure to maintain the dilation schedule is the most common cause of lost depth. For phalloplasty, recovery is longer and typically staged across multiple surgeries. The initial flap surgery requires several weeks of immobilization of the donor site. If it's the forearm, that arm is essentially out of commission. Then there's usually a separate surgery for the urethral connection, and another for the erectile implant if the patient wants one. We're talking about a process that can span a year or more.
That's a significant commitment, and it underscores why the informed consent model matters. People need to understand exactly what they're signing up for.
And the regret rates for these surgeries are consistently low, below 1% in most studies. That's lower than knee replacement surgery. The narrative of widespread regret is not supported by the data.
The regulatory landscape is a patchwork. You've got countries with informed consent models, the US, Canada, Australia, where an adult can access care after being informed of the risks without mandatory psychiatric evaluation. Then you've got countries like Japan and many European nations that require formal psychiatric diagnosis and a period of real-life experience, living as the identified gender before surgery is approved.
The World Professional Association for Transgender Health, WPATH, publishes the standards of care that most providers reference. Version 8 came out in 2022, and it moved decisively toward informed consent. It also removed the requirement for multiple referral letters for surgery in many cases. But WPH guidelines aren't binding law. Individual countries and even individual US states set their own rules.
That's where the political axis becomes stark. In the US, Democratic-controlled states have been passing what are called shield laws. California, New York, Colorado, that protect access to gender-affirming care and shield providers and patients from out-of-state prosecution. Meanwhile, 22 Republican-controlled states have passed bans on gender-affirming care for minors as of 2026, Florida, Texas, Alabama. These aren't restrictions, they're outright prohibitions with criminal penalties for providers.
The international picture is just as fragmented. Argentina passed its gender identity law in 2012, Law 26.743, which allows legal gender change based on self-declaration alone, no medical gatekeeping, no surgery requirement, no judicial approval. It's one of the most progressive frameworks in the world. Thailand, which has long been a destination for gender confirmation surgery, included gender recognition provisions in its proposed same-sex marriage bill in 2024.
Then you look at the UK, and it's going in the opposite direction. The CAS review, published in April 2024, recommended restricting puberty blockers to clinical trials only. The National Health Service implemented that restriction. Sweden and Finland have also tightened access to youth care. So you've got this global divergence. Latin America and parts of Asia moving towards self-determination. The Anglosphere and parts of Europe pulling back.
What's fascinating and troubling if you care about evidence-based policy is that the divergence doesn't track medical evidence. It tracks political alignment. Countries with similar medical capabilities and similar research output have wildly different policies. The UK and Argentina aren't making different decisions because the science looks different from London than from Buenos Aires. They're making different decisions because the political calculus is different.
That's the core of it, isn't it? This debate is fundamentally about values, not science. Both sides cite studies. Both sides claim the evidence supports their position, but the actual policy decisions are being made on political grounds.
The lobby group dynamics reflect that. On one side, you have organizations like the Human Rights Campaign, GLAAD, and Transgender Europe, which have shifted over the past decade from a tolerance framing, please accept us, to a human rights framing. This is a fundamental right and you're violating it. That shift has been effective in international forums and in liberal democracies with strong human rights traditions.
On the other side, you got the Heritage Foundation, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and a network of organizations that have coordinated model legislation. The Don't Say Gay bills, bathroom bills, sports bans. These aren't spontaneous grassroots efforts. They're the product of coordinated legal strategy. The Alliance Defending Freedom alone has been involved in drafting legislation in dozens of states.
The framing on that side has shifted too. It's moved from explicitly moral condemnation, which polled badly, to a protecting children and women's safety framing. The sports issue in particular has been effective politically because it taps into broader anxieties about fairness in women's athletics.
I want to pause on the sports issue, because it's become such a flashpoint. The number of elite trans athletes is vanishingly small. We're talking about a handful of cases across all of competitive athletics, but the political energy around it is enormous. It's become a proxy for a much larger cultural debate.
The science is genuinely complex. Testosterone suppression reduces muscle mass and bone density, but the extent and timeline vary by individual and by when suppression began. There's no simple answer to the fairness question that applies uniformly across all sports and all ages, but the political debate doesn't have room for that complexity. It's been reduced to slogans.
One thing that makes this debate uniquely difficult to resolve with data is the prevalence gap. We don't actually have reliable global numbers. Estimates range from 0.1% to 1.2% of the population, depending on definition and methodology. The Williams Institute at UCLA estimated 1.6 million Americans, about 0.6%, identified as transgender as of 2022, but that's based on self-report in a survey, and we know that stigma suppresses self-reporting.
That data gap gets exploited constantly. You'll see someone cite a specific number as if it's established fact. Transgender identity has increased 500% in teenagers, without mentioning that the baseline was near zero because nobody was measuring it, or that the increase correlates almost perfectly with increased social acceptance and changes in survey methodology.
This is where historical perspective becomes useful. When you know that gender diversity has been documented across cultures for four millennia, the claim that this is a sudden social contagion looks less like analysis and more like a talking point. Prevalence estimates have remained relatively stable when you control for social acceptance and survey design.
The idea that most transgender people undergo surgery, that's another misconception. Many don't, and surgery isn't required for gender identity to be valid. The medical consensus is clear on that point. Transition is individualized. For some people it's social, for some it's hormonal, for some it's surgical, and for many it's some combination.
We've seen everything from Argentina's self-determination model to Florida's ban on youth care. What should we take away from this patchwork?
First, historical perspective matters. The current panic about transgender identity being a new phenomenon is historically illiterate. Gender diversity has been documented across cultures for millennia. Understanding that history doesn't resolve the policy debates, but it should inoculate us against the claim that we're dealing with something unprecedented.
Second, access to gender confirmation care is determined less by medical evidence and more by political alignment. Countries with similar medical capabilities have wildly different policies. That doesn't mean the medical evidence is irrelevant. It means the debate is fundamentally about values, and we should be honest about that rather than pretending science will resolve it.
Third, when you're evaluating claims about transgender issues, check the source. Is it citing actual prevalence data from the Williams Institute or WPATA, or is it using rhetorical framing? When someone throws out a specific number without methodology, be skeptical. The data gap is real, and it gets exploited.
The trajectory seems clear. We're seeing a global divergence that will likely intensify. More countries in Latin America and parts of Asia are adopting informed consent and self-determination models. Meanwhile, U.S. red states and parts of Europe are restricting care. We're not converging on a global consensus. We're splitting into separate regulatory worlds.
Which raises a question I keep coming back to. As genetic testing and prenatal screening advance, will we see pressure to prevent transgender identity before birth? This is already being discussed in bioethics circles. If a genetic marker associated with gender dysphoria were identified, and to be clear, no such marker has been established, would we see the same kind of selective pressure that's been applied to other traits?
That's a deeply uncomfortable question. And it's not hypothetical. The technology is advancing, and the ethical frameworks aren't keeping pace. We've already seen this play out with Down syndrome, where prenatal screening has led to dramatic reductions in birth prevalence in some countries. If a marker were found, the pressure to select against it would be enormous, and the disability rights community has been warning about this exact scenario for decades.
It raises the question of what we're actually selecting against. Is it gender dysphoria, the distress? Or is it gender diversity itself? Because those are not the same thing. If you could identify a fetus that would grow up to be transgender but would live in a society that fully accepted them, would there be any medical reason to intervene? The distress is at least partly socially mediated.
The next frontier is likely non-binary and gender-fluid recognition. Germany, Canada, and Australia already offer X-gender markers on passports. How do medical and legal systems adapt to identities that don't fit binary categories?
The binary medical model, you transition from one to the other, doesn't map well onto non-binary identities. If someone wants partial medical transition, or no medical transition but legal recognition as non-binary, our current systems struggle with that. The WPA Standards of Care version 8 started addressing it, but most national regulatory frameworks haven't caught up.
I think about the practical problems. If you have an X marker on your passport, what happens when you travel to a country that doesn't recognize it? What happens with automated border control systems that are programmed for M or F? These seem like minor technical issues, but they're the kind of thing that creates real friction in people's lives.
The legal precedents are still being established. We're in the very early days of courts figuring out what non-binary recognition means for everything from marriage law to prison assignment to anti-discrimination protections. It's going to take decades to sort out.
The question Daniel's prompt ultimately raises isn't just how long has this been around or how does the surgery work? It's what kind of societies do we want to be? Are we going to recognize the full range of human gender diversity that's been documented across cultures for thousands of years? Or are we going to enforce a binary that the historical record shows was never universal?
That's a values question, not a science question. Science can tell us about prevalence and complication rates and outcomes. It can't tell us whether self-determination or gatekeeping is the right approach. That's a political and ethical judgment.
Which is why, for all the data we've discussed today, this debate isn't going to be resolved by more studies. It's going to be resolved, or not, by political contestation. And right now, that contestation is producing a global patchwork that's getting more fragmented, not less.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The so-called War of the Triple Alliance Succession Crisis of 1864 was long attributed to a dispute between Paraguay's Francisco Solano López and Brazil's Emperor Pedro II. In fact, the initial diplomatic rupture was triggered by a misattributed letter from a Uruguayan diplomat in Tierra del Fuego who falsely claimed Brazilian naval support for a coup, a forgery that wasn't identified until Argentine archives were declassified in 1973.
A forged letter from Tierra del Fuego. Next episode, we're going deeper into the surgical techniques themselves, from those first procedures in 1920s, Berlin, to the robotic-assisted vaginoplasty being trialed now. The evolution of the actual craft is remarkable. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumintop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can email the show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll see you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.